Hello and welcome to Carnegie Conversations, the podcast where we explore the science of performance. I'm Tanya Arnold, and on this episode, we're going to be talking about the instrumented mouthguards. You may have heard about them. They're being used in both codes of rugby to help detect and prevent head injuries. But did you know that the Carnegie School of Sport here at Leeds Beckett University has played a key role in developing them? Head injuries in both codes of rugby have become a big issue. A lot of work is being done here and has been done here, led by Ben Jones and his team. He's working alongside Carl Hogan from Prevent Biometrics and Ross Tucker, the sports scientist for World Rugby. Now, we took a straw poll as to who's going to answer this first question. Ross, you got lucky. What is it that is in a player's mouth? What are you looking at from a player in their mouth that tells you they've got concussion and they need to come off?
So without trying to be facetious, teeth that are attached to a skull. And what that then allows you to do is to put a device that's anchored in effect to the skeleton, the skull, so that you can very accurately measure the acceleration of the head. And the reason you're interested in measuring the acceleration of the head is because when a brain injury occurs, it's the consequence of the movement of the brain inside the skull. So as opposed to waiting for a clinical outcome from a head impact, you can now measure the thing that's causing that clinical outcome. And you get all this really interesting data that allows you to start predicting and potentially preventing when these head injuries will happen with clinical consequences. So the specific device is a mouthguard, which contains an accelerometer, and it tells you how much the head has moved forward, backwards, and rotates, and that has implications for what's happening to the brain.
So, Ben, when did you first get involved in this and kind of get involved in researching this and finding out what would work?
So during 2021, Leeds Rhinos were working with Prevent Biometrics and they were piloting the devices. And our involvement there was around collecting some data, looking at the validity of the mouthguard and different instrumented mouthguards. And then we saw the potential quite quickly and then upscaled in terms of working then with the rugby league. So all professional men's and women's players in rugby league now wear them, working with World Rugby in terms of supporting some of their data analysis and a number of studies. But I suppose our main contribution early on was around being cynics of the device. Yeah. So we wanted to run some validation studies with different mouthguards before we pushed the adoption. And I think the validity was more than just the tech. It was the feasibility. Do players like them? Can people use them? Because ultimately we know that if the device was perfect but nobody wore it or used it, it'd be a pointless device.
So were you evangelical about them at Prevent, Carl?
I think we're realistic about what's needed. My background and a lot of the guys' background have seen sports technology evolve, and we understand that there's a validation that's needed. Otherwise, the technology gets ahead of itself and collapses, to be quite honest with you. You know, I've seen that with various technologies in sport, particularly at the elite level, high levels of adoption early on. And if it's not validated, if it's not researched in the right way, you lose the value proposition of what it really is. So I think we welcomed it. It was hard. It was really hard.
I think on that, the concept of measuring head acceleration was not 2021. That existed long before. Yeah. And so, for instance, you could put that same accelerometer into a helmet. The problem is a helmet moves on the head, so you're not measuring head movement. There were teams that were using a patch that used to sit behind the ear that alleged to do the same thing, but then it's a patch moving on the skin, on the skull. And so when I sort of jokingly said teeth, the difference is that now you can very tightly couple the accelerometer to the head through the teeth, and then you can unlock the ability to measure this accurately. So you can go back decades for the concept of head acceleration, but the tool that does it well is actually quite new.
So who decided teeth?
Even instruments and mouthguards, they've been around before that. And I think the concept of teeth and skull makes sense. Mm. But then think about the concept of accurately measuring your head movement while also thinking about somebody being punched in the mouth, biting, taking it out, shouting, putting it back in. The early versions of the instrumented mouthguards, they were just really noisy sensors, which had the potential because they were on the teeth. Mm. And then the validity study that we initially did, which had four commercially available mouthguards, we saw different in performance. And actually the main reason why we did the validity study, because we saw the potential for measuring head impacts in players, and we saw the importance of getting it right. And we saw the importance of having a coordinated approach that every player across the sport needed to wear the same mouth guard. Otherwise, everyone would just be collecting their own data and we'd get no insights from the sport. And that's why we went at this quite aggressively in terms of making sure that we were confident in the technique, the mouth guard, but then the device that measured the head acceleration events. Mm.
So what is it if your pitch side presumably is somebody monitoring on a computer and they suddenly get a blip? What is it that they see pitch side that says, I need to go and get that player?
So for the first few years of this technology existing, we put it in as many players' mouths as possible. And really all you're doing scientifically is measuring. Let's describe what happens. And you end up with literally hundreds of thousands of data points because every tackle, every carry, every ruck involvement, every contact is a data point. And then what you do is you say, what's the spread of that data? And at what point does the magnitude of the head impact become high enough to become potentially clinically meaningful? And potentially I'll put in bold, underlined, and we'll come back to it. Because what you're not doing is saying that when your head accelerates beyond X and Y, you're concussed. You're saying you've had a big, big head impact. And it's prudent and conservative to put you in front of your doctor, let them have an assessment, and potentially diagnose a concussion. But even if you haven't been diagnosed with a concussion, there's still value in knowing you'd experienced that big head impact because we now think that they accumulate and they might have consequences beyond, hey, he's concussed or she's had a concussion. So we now have ability to measure below concussion and potentially above that threshold. So simple answer to your question is if a head acceleration exceeds certain limits that we determine statistically, have a screen, come off the field, let's have a look.
But you are looking, I mean, when you're doing testing, presumably were you looking at individual players? Somebody is looking at, in rugby league, 13 players on the pitch, in union, 15 players. And, you know, if you're getting these data points the whole time, I mean, that's a lot to keep across.
So where rugby league and rugby union differed with the application of the mouth guard is, so concussions are a challenge because concussions are common in rugby unless you think about it at a player level. So you take rugby league, there's one concussion every two games, okay? So across a season, there's over 100 concussions. But actually, if that one concussion is over two games and you've got the 34 players in a match and then you extrapolate that out, it's actually quite rare at a player level. So in rugby league, it actually took us a long time to get any data where there was a concussion and a mouth guard because we rolled out across one league, where World Rugby managed to get there much quicker because you rolled out globally.
Yeah, and so we could accelerate the process. But the big breakthrough in terms of the sideline communication, and you might talk a little bit about this in the development side, is the accelerometer is storing all the data. So afterwards, you can put the mouth guard, you can download all the data, and you can spend all the time in the world with it. But what you developed is a system where the mouth guard could actually push an alert to an iPad on the side of the field. And so the match day doctor is looking at an app. And when that single impact that exceeds those thresholds is experienced by the mouth guard, Bluetooth signal on the iPad, blue 13, off you come.
So for context, it has the mouth guard is a mouth guard, so it protects the teeth. But it has a miniaturized battery. It has a miniaturized circuit board, which does all the smart stuff. And then it has a Bluetooth antenna as well. So what we've been able to do as Prevent Biometrics is we actually do all the calculations, which is quite complex firmware, on the mouth guard itself. And then through that Bluetooth antenna, you can quickly send a signal, whether it's directly to a referee or it's to a sideline in the case of rugby union. And that live element of it and the ability for us to do that on the device has meant that we can quickly get a signal across before even sometimes the video review's been done of a particular situation. So, you know, we're down to seconds now for this information to be transmitted. Like 15 years has taken to develop. It didn't happen overnight. But yeah, that allowed it to scale really quickly in rugby union particularly.
And then you see what that means is that the match day doctor and the people, they don't have to worry about 750 impacts in a game. They only really need to pay attention when the alert arrives.
Absolutely fantastic. I am going to ask you, I'm going to go with you, Ross, just because you copped for the mouth question. You talked about men and women playing. Mm. Difference? Is it a different concussion level? Are you looking for a different thing for the female players to the men?
Yeah, so the women's threshold is lower than the men's. So in the elite women's game, a head acceleration that is smaller than in the men's game would be enough to have the player removed. And the reason is, and it was one of the most interesting early findings with the data, is that women experience head accelerations far less often than men do. And that's not because they don't make as many tackles and rucks and carries. They do the same things, but those things are just less likely to cause them. So when we describe head acceleration events as measured by the mouth guard, in general, men might experience 20 in a match, women 10 each. So it's about half. And the big ones, even less. It's about a third as common in women's rugby than it is in men. And that's really interesting because the concussion data we have shows that the concussion rates are similar between men and women. So now you have a paradox of sorts, because how can women have the same concussion outcomes with fewer head accelerations? And now you go down this whole avenue of susceptibility to concussion. And that's an example of something you wouldn't know if you weren't measuring it with a mouth guard. So we have a new theory to explore thanks to the data. But in short, yeah, women come off at a lower head acceleration event than men do.
And are you learning about individual players as well? Is there a difference between individual players who may be more susceptible to a concussion than others?
Yeah, we spotted it quite early, didn't we? Like our first question, which is a logical one when you're doing this, is how many does an average player have in a match head acceleration? And then what's the average probability of a tackle or a carry to result in a head acceleration event? And we saw quite early that there was that the differences in the number of head acceleration event that players were getting wasn't driven around different probabilities on average. It was actually driven around just being involved in more contact events. So like forwards or backs in a game don't have a different chance of getting a head acceleration event. Forwards just involved in more collisions. But we almost didn't believe that because forwards and backs are inherently different in their collision characteristics. And then we started to explore this in more detail, and it was through the work of James Tooby, who's a PhD student here. And he started to plot these individual differences. So in rugby league, we'd seen that the average probability of a player getting a head acceleration event above 25G was about 5%. And there were some players in the data set that was 35%. And then if the average number, we've just been doing some work on the global data set, if the average number of head acceleration events above 25G in rugby union for men is 3, there's some players in the data set that was 12, 14, 16. So this allows us to actually manage individuals because we're actually counting the thing that is putting them at potential risk.
And does it differ between the two codes?
Not that element of it. I've seen the data from Rugby League and in Union, it's the same picture. You'll have players in the same position who make broadly the same number of tackles, carries and contact involvements with fivefold differences in head acceleration events. And that plot is exactly the same in league, right?
Yeah.
And that's really interesting because if your intention ultimately is to manage head impacts, then some players are just more susceptible. So now you can target interventions. Is that technique? Is that something else, neck strength potentially, that might be targeted? But suddenly you've got these opportunities to design things that you wouldn't have known about before.
But I think that part of the interesting thing that we've been able to paint with this is we started this talking about concussion, and everybody recognised concussions are risk and concussions are bad and we should prevent them. And then you start to think, right, well, if we're going to measure head acceleration events and every time the head impacts, there's a chance here that we absolutely expose the players being to a risk that we didn't know. And what we actually see is most players have a low number of head acceleration events. And then there's this tail. There's just these outliers. And the same thing for, take men's rugby union, 50% of tackles and carries won't even result in the mouth guard triggering. Mm. They're below a threshold, and that threshold is well below normal daily activity. So actually you start to become really precise with painting the higher risk, and even more precise when you start to paint the high risk players in those high risk events, which is the prevention piece.
So what was the reaction to players as you start, you've got a bit of kit that's very clever and is going to help them? Did they go, yay, fantastic, bring it on?
Lots of them did. Definitely. But there's lots of skepticism around, well, let's just call it out, like the litigation around, you know, the sports and their ability, you know, their players' ability to get insurance. I've spoke to a lot of the elite players, particularly in rugby union, but also in league. And will this stop me from being able to get insurance? Will it help me get insurance? Does this stop me taking a lawsuit out at some point in the future? Just being straight up. Does it feel as comfortable as my last mouth card? I've had this mouth card for 10 years. You know, there's a change there. I think they were mainly intrigued. And I always find, different to some other sports, but in rugby league in particular, but certainly rugby union, they're willing to adopt technology quickly. If you ask them to run with a fridge on the back, they probably would. So they were very, very happy to, you know, look at this. But that's where the research comes in, because I think you can come in with a technology and you can try and convince these players. But if you've got the research to back it, and you have the governing body as well talking about this, as well as World Rugby did with the Players Association, that adoption curve is a lot faster.
And one of the things in Rugby League that we did concurrent to evaluating the mouthguard's validity was we surveyed all the players, and professional and community players, and it was 60% of players were concerned around the long-term implications of concussion, and 20% of players said that they hid concussion from medical staff. That's potentially one in five not being even reported. And the main reason that they said was they didn't want to let their team down and didn't want to be ruled out of a match. So actually you play that back and players are inherently concerned around the potential risks until it gets to game day and kickoff, and then they just put their bodies on the line. So actually this was a really good tool to protect people from themselves and that window of the highest risk.
The level of sport might be something there as well, because if you're on a low-value contract, which can be the case in some of the rugby league, right, this is life and death sort of stuff, isn't it? And if it's going to keep me out of training in a game, then there is definitely a resistance there. But I'll go back to, I think the codes of these sports have a culture which is to typically adopt technology if it comes from the right, you know, if it comes from the research world, if it comes from the governing body. I've seen that they've been willing to adopt. Rugby league's been innovative, right? Ref cams and, you know, TMO. It's an innovative sport. And I would say overall the adoption has been easier than maybe in soccer or some other sports like that.
The story of how we started the rugby league project. So once we started this was before the validity study. Carl, you previously worked at another sports technology company and they do game-wide player tracking. We'd had all the players in GPS units so we could see what they were doing. Rugby league had a league-wide agreement, so essentially we managed the data. And during COVID, we were standing, players were having to isolate based on government guidelines. And actually what we started to see was the players that were standing down weren't developing COVID. So actually we worked with government around relaxing the guidelines because we could precisely say who was near who when they were infectious and did they get infected. And all the Super League owners saw that as just us owning our own risk and actually being in control of that, because otherwise the assumption is things are higher risk. And we literally organised a call with all 12 Super League CEOs and spoke to them of the concept of actually there's a technology now which allows us to measure what's happening to a player. And like within months, they just agreed and they all commit to the project.
Mandating is different to saying, look, I've got this for you, and this will help you. When you're told you have to, was that a bit more of a barrier in that, you know, you're being told and you couldn't play, could you? If you didn't wear it, you weren't allowed to play. That's a different kind of line.
Yeah, that was a big sliding doors moment for Union. Because we also started it just after the COVID lockdowns, in the community game initially, then the elite game. But our position was that we needed these devices in as many players' mouths as possible for the same reason. Like, there's a 20-year problem here where a player who's 30 now and retires in 20 years' time at the age of 50, potentially going to develop some clinical consequences, and now you can measure why that might have happened. So we wanted it widespread, but it wasn't being used by as many players as we needed it to be. So we discussed mandating. And the players didn't want to go that way. So we couldn't mandate it as a requirement to step onto the field. But we could mandate it as a requirement to access the head injury processes that exist in the sport. So I have a knock in the game, I come off, I get a screen, I could go on, I could stay off, and then I get diagnosed as concussed. That part requires the mouthguard now. So that was the bypass almost. It's a mandate without being a mandate to play, if that makes sense. Now, that was met with some resistance for the same reasons that these guys have just mentioned, is players want to stay on the field. This is how they earn their livelihood and they love doing it. And now you've got a device that could see them removed when they wouldn't have been before. So that there was definitely resistance to it. I think there still is a little bit, actually, to be honest, because it's so new that I don't think its long-term benefit hasn't yet been realized in order to weigh up against that perceived cost.
But I think in terms of player resistance, so World Rugby mandated as part of the HRN and then Rugby League followed. But the uptake in Rugby League pre-mandate was about 20%.
Same opinion.
Which, going back to the CEO's conversation, they're investing in a project to buy instrument mouthguards. We were scanning players, deploying, yep. And there was about 20% uptake. Once we mandated in 1 January 2024, that I think it's about 85%, and actually we didn't get that much pushback. So I actually think that people, just going back to that, I'm concerned, but the game's important. I think that kind of push rather than nudge just helped people just go, all right, I'll do it.
And we weren't reckless. I spoke earlier about the removal from play based on a mouthguard is based on the size of the head acceleration. So there's an alert threshold. When we set that, we were very deliberate and careful not to set it so low that we would be needlessly interfering with the match. So you have to also, from a welfare perspective, respect that there's a performance element here. So the threshold is set at a pretty high level, and it's not going to pull a player off because they had a nudge on the head. It's a big impact. So we stand behind that, and you make the argument to the players, and then eventually they do accept it. But of course, if my desire is to stay on the field and there's something that could remove me and I'm going to pass the head injury assessment, why did you remove me? That remains. And so there's a significant educational challenge, I think, still now, but it's here and it's not going away. And our figures are now the same. It's in the 80 to 90% range for use.
What about those players who aren't wearing it? What happens with them, so to speak?
So it depends whether they've chosen not to wear it for no reason. Then they don't get access to the head injury process. And so if they experience a head impact that looks like it could be a concussion, they get treated as a recognize and remove case. In other words, they're just substituted off and diagnosed as concussed. So in a sense, the risk they're taking is they're more likely to be diagnosed as concussed, whereas the HIA process evaluates them in a three-step process. But there are players for whom using the mouthguard is not possible for medical reasons. They may have braces, they may have an excessive gag reflex, and then they're given what are called exemptions, and then they can access it even without the mouthguard.
So how much does this cost? It sounds a really clever bit of kit. How much does one of those cost?
How much do you think it costs?
I have not a clue. I wouldn't know what an ordinary one without a chip in it would cost. So.
Yeah, so it's a custom fit mouthguard. That would cost you around £60 to £100, maybe even more if you went and had that fitted without a chip. So we're around the £200 mark at the moment. The challenge for our business is, how do you scale and bring the price down? We want this to be available to as many people as possible. You have to go in a very controlled way, research, probably top of the pyramid to start off with the elite level, and then work your way down. But we think we can get this as low as £100, £50 at some point in the future. And the barriers to this technology compared to others is very different. People already wear mouthguards. You're not asking them to put a new piece of kit on. We've looked at the ability to reuse some of the circuitry boards in here, which potentially could last 5 to 10 years. So there's a huge opportunity here in all contact sports to really drive the price down and make this available to everyone. But we're going to go very methodical and work at the right levels with the governing bodies as well, because there are protocols in place at all levels of sport for concussion, or in most sports. And this needs to complement all the years of research and work that's gone into that if it's going to become adopted globally. And there's a huge opportunity in rugby union. It's less large in rugby league, but super valuable for us. But there's other sports as well. We've just won a big tender down in Australia, and the biggest sport down there. And that's a huge opportunity. Over 1 million people are playing that sport in, you know, one concentrated area. So
I was going to ask about school kids, because, you know, both codes are suffering a bit of a crisis. You know, there's been a lot about head injuries, and a lot of parents are thinking, don't want my kid playing this. I'm going to ask you about tackle heights in a little bit as well, because that's been part of it. But, you know, to have this bit of kit available for school kids who are playing, is that going to be possible? Because, you know, they're still growing, so their mouths are going to, it's not a one-off payment, is it? I mean, how can we get this to the point that pretty much anybody who's playing rugby union does have access to it?
Conceptually, I'd say not just possible, but immensely valuable. If and this is the key, you manage some of the potential for chaos and risk of introducing it at such a wide base and broad level, because there is a real risk there that without the necessary education and the density or number of expert people who can make sure that it's being used adequately, you just actually create noise. Because you can imagine a situation where 30 kids are playing a game and 28 of them have got mouth guards in, and the parents are all trying to keep an eye on what's happening because they're concerned and they're invested in the health of the child who's playing. And if they're not fully equipped to understand what the data means and what they're seeing, then you are in effect contributing to noise. So we have to be quite careful about it. There is a plan in place to try and study the community game in order to support those kinds of phased rollouts. So I think it is the next horizon, and we'll get to that point, but it's going to need to be underpinned by such widespread effective education campaigns and technology and apps that make it easy to consume and make decisions against the data. Because at the moment, you've got very specialized experts who are looking at the data and making informed decisions on players' behalves. You probably don't want that to happen on massive scale.
And if you think about community or school, rugby league, rugby union, whichever, you've got concussion, which again, everyone acknowledges is a risk and bad, but they're even more rare at the community level. Yeah. They're much more infrequent, and also the threshold by which players come off, because they're not even concussions, they're potential concussions, because it's recognise and remove.
But is it, do they recognise? I mean, certainly at school level, my best friend's son got a kid, yeah. And they didn't spot it.
Yeah.
He went back on, you know, he'd come off, they sent him back on. And he had got a concussion.
He shouldn't have gone back on based on protocol. But a mouth guard wouldn't stop somebody.
But they would have spotted the concussion he'd had, wouldn't they, if he'd had that?
But the protocols at the moment are recognise and remove. So if...
They just didn't recognise.
Well, if he came off, they clearly recognised and removed him. By coming off means he can't go back on. They can't do a HIA because they're not a doctor.
And that's why it's immensely valuable, because let's say there are 100 concussions that happen. Recognize and remove, we know it's got limitations. So let's say 70 are detected. Of the other 30, half, 10, mouth guard may pick up. So it's going to add to the ability of the community game to recognize when those concussions have happened. But it's also a debate that moves beyond concussion, because all the contact sports have been in effect forced to account not just for the big ones that cause the concussion, but the accumulation of the head impacts over the course of a career. And that's the device that allows you to measure that in order to manage it. So it's not, its value is not limited to the one that you could see clinically and can confirm with a mouth guard. It's the ones that you may not have seen before and the ones that might be accumulating below the concussion threshold or the clinical threshold, whatever you want to call it.
Where do you see the rollout going, Carl, in terms of how deep you can go into the sport?
I think it's hand in. I agree with everything Ross said, and I think it has to be hand in hand with research. And you need to go methodically and work out what does an under 13s girl and head accelerations look like compared to an under 16s boy, and get enough data to feel confident in that. And then the whole education piece is there. Kids under the age of 12, I think it's adult males up until 16. And girls, typically you probably need a new mouth guard every year because their teeth change, right? And I think it was girls 16 and maybe it's boys 18. So these things need to be done every single year. There's a logistics in that, which we think we can solve. They're wearing mouth guards anyway. So this is about how do you then swap out the existing mouth guards for something that has a board in at the right cost with the right infrastructure support, but it has to be done top down. And one of the biggest challenges we've sort of set ourselves up for success, we think, is it's a team-based product. So the team manages this. So the coach manages it, or the sports scientist manages it, or a parent can manage it. But on the individual level, all the data is fed up into an application. Or if it was an alert, maybe that goes to a referee, or maybe that goes to someone who's responsible on the sideline for saying, there's a player over there, number 7, who needs to come off, and we either need to check them or they're recognised and remove, or whatever that protocol is. So I think we've set ourselves up where we can get a long way down into this huge, vast market, right? There's 60 million in combat sports. There's 8.4, because rugby union is actually growing, by the way, at the sort of volume, at, you know, the total volume level. A lot of those are young kids, though, in rugby union who are coming through. And I think you have lots of parents, once they hit a certain age, who are like, is this available? I'd love to have the security of this. but hand in hand with research, it will be done in the right way. And I think member associations as well, it's different in England to what it is in France, to what it is in Japan. That's complex as well. But fundamentally, we've got good technology that can make its way down. And we think we can get this to the right price point where it can become available to pretty much everyone.
Yeah, so that's your challenge to solve. I'll give you one example of a challenge, though, is if the users of this device are over-reliant on it as a concussion diagnostic tool, then you could create exactly the opposite behaviors you want. So, for example, in the elite men's game, the removal threshold is 75 Gs linear acceleration and 4,500 for the rotational. So if you exceed both of those, off you come. A lot of concussions happen below those. We see concussions at 20 Gs and 2,000 radians per second rotation. And similarly, there's not many, but there are head impacts that exceed those thresholds that are not eventually concussions. So an over-reliance, let's say this is now used in school sports, and a parent said, but my son only had 30 Gs and 3,000. He can't be concussed because he's way below the threshold. Mm. Now you've overruled a medical condition based on a number. So we have to constantly educate people that it's not perfectly diagnostic. It's been a challenge in the elite game is to try and explain that to doctors. So imagine how much more that challenge exists for parents. And but the point is you anything you can add to the process in a way that makes better decisions, better management. And eventually, I think the big value is going to be not the single event, but the ability to track over a month, a season, a career, a lifespan in the sport. How many head accelerations have I had? Am I a high or a low? If I'm a high person, what do I need to change to try and bring my head accelerations down? And that's information that changes behavior. And that's where it becomes more powerful. But it's the long game. I think people get a little bit too excited maybe about the short game.
One of the biggest challenges early on with the adoption with clubs and club staff is they told us they didn't work because they said half the tackles, it's not giving me anything. Mm-hmm. And 5% of the tackles, it's giving me three. Because actually it's measuring something different than what people were used to. Mm. So people were precisely managing collision load based on how many contacts a player was involved in, how many collisions, how long, all that video analysis data is there. And then we gave them a device and they would, telling us that it was wrong. Yeah, mm-hmm. And actually it wasn't until you showed them that actually like half of these like are below a threshold to trigger the mouth guard. And I think it was either 5 or 10%, probably 5% that were resulted in three head acceleration events. There was initial contact, there was somebody else coming in, and then there was a head to ground. Mm. So the mouth guard reports three when they see one. So I think that and that was early on, probably the first 3-6 months, and we did a lot of education. We did like fortnightly calls with the practitioners managing these, but it's new and it's not what the eye see.
And the same thing happened. You take a player off for the screen because they exceed that threshold, and that threshold, that 75-4,000, that's literally a 1 in 1,000 event. And then they look at it and they say, but that's a typical rugby tackle. Well, I guarantee you it's not. A typical is not a 99.9% event, a 1 in 1,000. And so we've discovered straight away that what the eye sees and what the mouth guard measures are not necessarily the same thing. But that's where the fact that it was validated in a laboratory setting and then in a field setting means we can stand confidently behind that and say, actually, we think your eye is wrong.
I know you've done a lot of work on tackle heights as well in rugby league. It's been a hot topic in both codes of rugby. How much do the two tie together? Do you think the work that you're doing with the mouth guard and the research that you've done into tackle heights, or are they two completely different areas?
Yeah, they're the same thing. The initial tackle height reduction in rugby league was based on concussion risk, and people always say that rugby league and rugby union are different, and there are differences, but actually, at a data level, scientifically, they're very similar. Ross led the early work in rugby union, and we then did that in rugby league. The results were the same. The highest risk is contact to the head. So tackle height was reduced to reduce head contact ultimately. Then we did all the work with the mouth guard and it showed the same thing. The highest probability of getting a high magnitude impact is tackling height, and it decreases, especially for the ball carrier, the lower you go.
And then it goes up again. So you have Goldilocks zone, you know, not too high, not too low, just in the middle. That's where you want to be, both sports.
From when you first started looking at all of this to where we are now, what changes have happened in concussion levels?
Concussions in Super League and Women's Super League have decreased, but the problem is that they do fluctuate year on year if you look at the trends. But they decreased last year and they're still trending down. I think our goal is around just making sure that we can keep them low. So we've seen that. But I think the point of this is it's a huge more awareness and there's more data. The biggest success that we had in any study that we did in rugby league was we reduced head-on-head collision rates in Women's Super League by 50% through a coaching intervention. And actually, the coaching intervention was actually not that well adopted. But the outcome of coaches providing a solution to a problem that they were being assessed against, which is head-on-head collisions, meant that they prioritised that within their tackle training. Because they were, because we were feeding back to them in terms of their head-on-head rates. So actually the whole new technology, the whole focus of precision around this has meant that everyone's aware of it and embracing it and doesn't want to be an outlier.
I've got to ask you about other sports, Carl, in that I watch football matches. I've watched a lot of rugby league. I've worked in rugby league for a long time. So, you know, I have seen a fair few head knocks. I've watched football matches and gone, how is that player still on the pitch? Why have they not taken them off? Is this something that you think other sports could, should adopt?
Yes, definitely. Let's take, I call it soccer because our business is based in the US. So maybe
we
I should.
Might let you off. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure. That's not good enough. So in football, we've had a flurry of inquiries from goalkeeper coaches and goalkeepers directly at championship level, prem level, across Europe as well. And I think that's because we've seen it on TV, right? We've seen it in major tournaments where a goalkeeper is just refusing to go off the pitch and they stay on and everyone's going, like, I've just seen him knocked out on the floor. So I think that might be a starting point for somewhere like soccer. We've actually got, you know, there's some interesting studies that are starting around mouth guards and heading the ball too. You know, there were rules that were brought in football around not heading the ball up until a certain age. The consequences of that, no one really knows. And I think this technology could have really informed that quite fundamental decision in the sport. You know, you can't head until the age of 14. I have no idea what that means in terms of the impact on your skull. And all of a sudden at 14, you start heading the ball. You're still cognitively developing. Your brain's still, you know, skull's still growing. So absolutely. But there are some easy, probably for us as a business, if you think about ice hockey and lacrosse, Aussie rules, we've got combat sports globally. These are all things where the application of this technology, whether it's the big ones or it's the volume, you know, particularly something like, you know, boxing. Interestingly, in combat sports, we've been contacted by the biggest managers of fighters and they're interested in adjudication, which I think is fascinating because actually there's lots of body blows and, you know, it won't pick up those, you know, perfectly. But they would like to have an objective score of, did I get punched in the face? Did that person get punched in the face?
I give you Tyson Fury, hit by Deontay Wilder. He's down. It is one of the iconic moments of boxing that he rises from the dead, comes back, the rest is history. If he'd been wearing an instrumented mouth guard and they've gone, is he pulled out that fight? I mean, you change boxing.
No.
But that's why, not happening. And that's why we can't stress enough that you don't diagnose the outcome based on the mouth guard.
You could sell, you know. I mean, boxing strikes me as just a different...
But that's about the volume, isn't it? And we've got recent experience. It's a sample of, let's say it's 50 in the world, but there's a very famous boxer who boxed against Tyson Fury, who uses one of ours in all of his pre-camps. And they look at, did he have a big session? And they use other technologies as well, right? Yeah. And they look at different levels of hydration and everything. But they use the mouth guard to see, as he had, how many punches has he had compared to his normal sparring session to the last camp that they did. So there's some anecdotal information there that as a practitioner in sports science, you might look at and go, that was quite a heavy session. Maybe we need to dial the next one back. I think that's just a really practical way. It's not diagnostic in any means.
But that's exactly what we hope the mouth guard becomes to the coaches. Because the moment it's a medical device, but I really do believe that as the tech is understood and as the implications of head impacts are understood as part of load, coaches will start saying in exactly the same way as that boxer, that on my squad, these three or four players need to have a lighter contact session because I know they've had more head impacts than everyone else. That's how to manage.
Are rugby players, both codes, wearing them in training? Because that has been one of the big discussion points is the match is one thing, it's what they were being put through in training.
Some are, I think, but I think that's it's a perception, and that narrative like keeps getting played back to us. That's not what we're seeing in the that's not what we're seeing in any of the studies. We see the higher rates and higher risk of higher magnitude head impacts in match is compared to training
by a lot.
One full training week is five full training weeks is equivalent to one match.
Yeah. So for every match. For every training impact, there are five in the match.
And where are you at now with the work that you're doing here, Ben? What's the next stage for you guys?
There's a number of things. One is we've done a really good job at looking at head acceleration events during like snapshot time windows. So during a match, during a training week, when we're precisely measuring. Now we've got to the point where we can actually look at these more cumulatively. One of the things that Rugby League introduced quite early on was match limits based on the duration a player plays. But actually then we've seen now that with the instrumented mouthguards that those don't directly relate to match limits. So we see players who play a lot and have low head acceleration event counts, and we see players that don't play a lot and have high head acceleration event counts. But the head acceleration events and the head impacts was the whole purpose of what we were trying to put all the preventative measures in. So you can now start to almost peel those back and actually just focus on the thing that matters, which is the head acceleration events. So the first one is being able to look at this at a higher level. So because this isn't about how many a player gets in a match, this is about how many a player gets over a career. That's ultimately where the risk starts to be realised. Mm. Thinking about it in terms of longer exposure. The other thing is we're collaborating with a number of different universities on some biomarker studies, so looking at proteins around brain injury and actually how those relate to the instrument in mouthguards, trying to triangulate what the mouthguard says to what actually physiological measures in the brain say, which then you can start to computationally redraw how the brain moves, as well as in the clinical assessment. So actually we can start to put some more meaningful thresholds in, because we've spoken a lot about the ceiling, you know, when does a player come off? But there's also the floor around when is it okay and when do we just carry on playing because the risk is low. And then one of the big things that we're really excited about is actually working with broader stakeholders, coaches being one, to actually reducing them. You know, we've measured now for a reasonable amount of time, 2-3 years, and I think we have to now start being more aggressive around managing, and I don't think that's the medical staff's responsibility. You know, medical staff treat the injury, but actually there's a whole coaching performance sports science staff which can actually prevent that player even presenting to the medical staff. So they're kind of the three work streams at the moment.
And Ross, do you see a point, talking about, you know, it is still relatively new, you know, you've not looked at the duration of a player's career, but, you know, looking down the line, do you see, you know, because you've got all this data, so a player that's starting now just breaks into the first team at 18, that you will be able to say, you know, 10 years into their career, you need to have a look at this. You need to look at this and have a think about where your future goes, because you are at a risk point.
Yes, but you don't want to wait 10 years. You know, you want to be able to put in place now already within the first month that you identify that player. So let's manage you now, keep you down, keep it lower. But you're right. What we will eventually have is a data set that we can look back on in a 55-year-old and quantify exactly what that player experienced through their professional rugby career. And that's massively valuable, because you'll find papers, for instance, in American football from NFL and college level players where they're guessing, sort of informed guesses, but still guesses, how many impacts a player had experienced in their career. And then they're relating that to these conditions like CTE and other neurodegenerative diseases. We don't want to guess. We want to measure so that we can start to manage. And that's the long game. That's the full picture here, I think, for us. But that's something probably we'd have this conversation in 2055, and we'll be able to say, based on what happened in 2025, we were able to start preventing, quantifying. Is there a threshold of head acceleration events that are more likely to cause those conditions later in life? We don't know, because we're literally in the first 3 years of what's going to take 20-odd years to begin to establish. So we have to be a bit patient. But the key message is, don't wait to the 10th year of a player's career when you can see the early signs of that problem developing in the first 10 weeks of that career.
But we've also been able to like move at almost light speed annually around the information that the mouthguard's given us and the research, because research is always criticised for being slow and the translation of research even slower. But actually, Ross and I presented on the World Rugby's Player Welfare Symposium. And when we go back to the previous year's slides, we actually forget how much it's come on, because like there's probably 20 papers a year.
Easily, yeah.
Yeah, that are looking at this. And obviously each of those papers provides a lot of information around describing the risk of the game, the risk to the player, ways in which we can reduce the risk. So I think collectively and collaboratively, sports universities and technology have moved at light speed, which I don't think, bar COVID, there's been an example of that.
No, I agree. So I always talk like in the analogy of like, you can, if you're trying to understand the full picture, you can get really close to it and you can examine one pixel at a time. That's what we used to do when we studied concussions. Here's one pixel, but you don't know what the picture says when you're studying one pixel. So you have to be able to step back, and that's what the mouth guards allowed us to do. So now we can see grids within the picture, and eventually we'll see the whole thing. And now it's the Mona Lisa, whatever it is. But Ben's right, like we're seeing grids at a rate that we've never seen before. So in that sense, it's quite exciting. Every match, for instance, is 800 data points. And every weekend there are 30 matches. So you think about it, in 2 years' time, we're going to have a million data points. So we have all these collaborations around the world to try and work with other people from different industries, people who've studied car crashes and understand that side of it, different sports, to try and maximize the value that we get out of this device. So I'm not saying we're going to sit on our hands for 20 years and then look. We look now. But the full picture will be visible in a generation or two worth of player. But the players playing now are going to be the first beneficiaries.
And just, Ben, finally, you know, for the Carnegie School of Sport, your team, the students that you work with, I mean, I suppose you're maybe in 20 years, you look back and pat yourselves on that, but you've been right at the beginning of this. It's quite a legacy.
Yeah, no, it has. And I think part of that is built around the partnerships that we've and the people we've been working with, whether that's Rugby League, whether that's Carl at Prevent, and previously when he was at another company, Ross and his colleagues at World Rugby. I think that the collaborative approach and the shared, I suppose, responsibility around trying to move this forwards has been immense. And, you know, we do a lot of work in Premiership Rugby, the RFU, et cetera. So, yeah, we're really proud of our contribution. And I think it's not... I don't think it's lost on us either in terms of the potential positive impact you can have. So we're moving as quick as we can, and but there's definitely more to come.
Well, it's an important field. Good luck to all of you with the work you're doing.
Thank you.
And if you want to know more about the work that Ben and his team are doing, head for the Carnegie School of Sport website. The details are in the show notes. And remember to like, follow and subscribe to the podcast, and tell all your mates about it as well. But from all of us, goodbye for now.